Hi, you're listening to Jeff Noble from the FASD Success Show. So, we know prenatal alcohol exposure is a risk factor for FASD. We have studies on high levels of prenatal alcohol exposure, but what about low levels? Up until now, we haven't had a study to share showing how low levels of prenatal alcohol exposure can affect the brain and behavior. My guest today is Dr. Catherine LaBelle. She discusses a recent study that they've done that has examined altered brain structure and function in children with low levels of prenatal alcohol exposure. If you don't know what that means, listen to the whole episode to find out. It's going to be a good one.
Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Yes, here we are, episode 104. Welcome and thank you for joining me. Whether this is your first episode or your 104th episode, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time. I know that you are busy, but we have an important job here. This podcast is all about creating success, FASD success in the individual and those caring for the individual and everybody else around them. And how do we do that, folks? We do that by talking to some amazing smart people. And today, we're talking to somebody who's wicked smart. We've had her on the show before, and she's just completed a new study, which I think will benefit all of us. But before we do that, may I say a few words? Here's a few of them. If you like what we're doing here at the FASD Success Show, by all means, subscribe to the show. It helps us. It helps you. It helps you because as soon as we have a brand new episode that pops up, boom, it's in your inbox. It's in your inbox, in your email. It's in your podcast player. However you subscribe and listen to us, it gets to you first and right away, so you don't have to go searching for it. Secondly, it tells the algorithm that our show is relevant and that when people are looking for FASD help, our show pops up. I just appreciate it. So thank you so much for doing that, and I hope you are well. This is the Easter weekend when I am recording this, and I wonder how your kids are doing. I wonder how you're doing. Have you changed your tradition? Have you made it less full of stimulation or the opposite? Did you go full stimuli and now you are paying for it? Either way, the plans changed here at the Noble household. We had my mother-in-law was coming up this weekend because we were pretty excited. We were going to go on a date and go to a concert. Tara got me some tickets for Christmas, and we were looking forward to getting away. But you know how life is, especially if you're raising an individual with FASD. And thus, Tara got the flu. She got the stomach flu, so that's what we spent the weekend doing. But in hindsight, it's kind of good that her mom was here too, so we could hold down the fort. And then, as soon as she started feeling better, little Olivia got it. Little Olivia is now sick with it. She's got a stomach bug, but she is a trooper. And now I'm just waiting for my turn. Do I just... I'm just waiting for my turn, so I'm getting this done as soon as I can in case I get it too. But what are you going to do? That's life, man. And I'm sure we'll figure something out in the future to do some sweet, sweet respite together. C'est la vie. You know, what do you do? What do you do? I tell you what you do. You dive into work. You dive in and you talk to some smart people like Dr. LaBelle. Honestly, this is important, and I'm so thankful that she reached out to me because there's a lot of misinformation out there. You hear you can have a little at this time. Some folks are saying not a drop. We know that there's no known safe amount. We have lots of studies that take a look at heavy amount of drinking, but not really studies on low levels, the effects of low levels of drinking alcohol. And Dr. LaBelle and Dr. Long did a study together, so we're going to talk about it. So it's like we go through the study together, and I look silly sometimes because I'm trying to read these big words, and you literally in real time listen to me wrap my head around some of the science. But Dr. LaBelle is amazing at breaking it down and making me not feel like a dum-dum. So who is Dr. LaBelle? Because we just got to get right to this, right? Because this is going to arm you if you are having conversations with other people about FASD who say, you know, just a little bit is okay. Now you're going to have a structured answer to that. So let's get her bio going in here. I love this bio because she does it in the first person. My research uses magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, to study brain development in children and adolescents. Using a variety of MRI techniques, I study how brain structure and function change with age or in response to treatments and interventions. I am specifically interested in how brain maturation and brain plasticity are related to cognition and behavior and how these relationships may be different in children with developmental disorders. The aim of my research is to better understand brain changes with the ultimate goal of providing early identification and more effective treatments for research with developmental disorders. She is from the University of Calgary. She was, I think, one of the top 40 under 40. She is a badass. Let's get to the interview with Dr. Catherine LaBelle. Are you ready? I'm ready. All right, let's go. All right, friends, here I am once again with Dr. Catherine LaBelle, becoming a reoccurring guest, and I'm not mad about it. Dr. LaBelle, thanks so much for being here again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I love talking science, and you're a scientist, and you're a scientist specifically doing great work in the area of fetal alcohol. On April 5th, you put out a new paper, a study, and it's called Evaluation of Brain Alterations and Behavior in Children with Low Levels of Prenatal Alcohol Exposure. So congratulations on doing that. So before we get into it, because folks, as I explained in the intro, I want to get into it. I want to go through this. We see these papers, they're shared on Twitter and Facebook. Besides the headline, like, what does it mean? And by finding out what it means in the guts of the study, it just arms us when we are out in the real world advocating, or if you're a trainer, that we can feel confident that we can share this information and know what the heck we're saying and what all the big words mean. Is that good with you, doctor?
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay. All right, Catherine, here we go. So real quick, why this study? Like, I know you're doing other studies. How did this study come about?
So obviously, we need to understand the brain in kids with prenatal alcohol exposure better. I think we can all agree on that. But many of the studies to date that have looked at that have looked at kids with very heavy prenatal alcohol exposure. And so that's important, but we don't know a lot about lower levels of prenatal alcohol exposure and how those impact the brain. And I think this is really, you know, we know the recommendations say no alcohol in pregnancy,
right?
But I think there's a huge segment of the population that doesn't actually believe that. And so I think there's a real need for evidence to understand what low levels of prenatal alcohol exposure, what they're associated with in terms of brain and behavior.
Okay. And before I go any further, folks, if you want to follow along, like honestly, you want to print out the study while you're listening to this, go to fasdsuccess.com/podcast. And you can just, it'll either be the first one that pops up or you can just scroll down, because I think this is going to be episode 104. And then you could do that and or plug your website or where it was posted so that people also could find it. Where is it at, Catherine?
So our lab website is developmentalneuroimaginglab.ca. And the paper's up on there. It was published also in a journal called JAMA Network Open. And so people can find it there. I can also send you the link to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Just so you have it.
Yeah. And just if you're on the fly, if you're listening to this and you're going, oh, I want to follow along, you can totally follow along and we'll do our best for the audio audience out there. Taking it back to what I was saying, it's also listed as Dr. Long here. Like, does someone just call someone up or you're just sitting at your desk? Like, see what I'm trying to say? Like,
yeah,
and you're just
for
like,
sure.
So I ponder. So, and then like, how did it form?
So Dr. Long is a research associate who's been working with me for about 6 years now. We've been working together. And so he's done a lot of other really great work looking at brain differences in children with prenatal alcohol exposure, both brain function and brain structure. And he's really amazing in terms of the analysis side of things. So he's kind of a wizard with being able to pull the numbers out of the brain images and those sorts of things. So we've been doing this kind of work for a long time, but always wondering about these lower levels of alcohol exposure, right? Always wondering about what it means and sort of wishing we could study it, but it's hard to recruit that population. It's hard to get really accurate data on exposure, you know, from some families, especially when kids are not with their biological families, it's hard to get accurate information on exposure. But we took advantage of this study out of the US. It's called the Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study, or ABCD. And they were,
okay.
So they recruited
this big long name or ABCD.
ABCD, yeah, exactly. Great. They recruited about 11,000 children across the US. Okay. And they collected huge amounts of information on these kids about family history, about the kids' current behavior, cognitive function. And they did brain scans in these kids as well. So there's this humongous data set and it's open for anyone to look at. And so we decided this would be a really great place to test this question of low levels of alcohol exposure. So we accessed this data set of 11,000 kids. And what we did is we picked out the kids who were still living with their biological birth mothers and who those mothers reported alcohol consumption in pregnancy. Okay.
Yeah.
And they reported amounts. So we were able to identify in this huge sample, 135 kids whose moms reported prenatal alcohol consumption and nothing else. So this is the other unique thing about this study.
Yeah,
no tobacco, no other drugs.
Well, that's reporting, but polysubstance use, right, is a thing, isn't it?
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So are you just saying just reporting? It's just reported that alcohol was all they used. So you had to just go with that.
That's right.
Okay. Okay.
That's right. But we, you know, there were several hundred children whose mothers reported polysubstance use.
Got
and
it.
We excluded them.
I understood. Okay?
So we only picked the kids whose moms reported alcohol alone.
Understood.
During pregnancy. Okay. And this is alcohol both before they knew they're pregnant and after they knew they're pregnant. So
Got
it's
it.
Also not just a week or whatever. And then because there were 11,000 kids in this sample, we took those other kids whose moms reported no exposure of any kind, no alcohol, no tobacco, no other drugs, either before they knew or after they knew they were pregnant. Okay. So all these kids whose moms reported nothing, and we matched them. We matched them on age, we matched them on sex, matched them on family income, matched them on parent education, and match them on caregiver status.
Oh, wow.
So
because I am assuming that other studies would be skewed one way.
Exactly.
And the other. So this is the data. This is a real control group, right?
That's what we were trying to do. Exactly. So many other studies, including ones that I've done. Okay. Mm-hmm.
We're not shitting on other scientists.
No. You just have this problem where you have differences. You know, many of the kids in your alcohol exposed group have been adopted, but mm-hmm. very few of your control participants have, or something like that. So, or postnatal trauma, you know, we know all these other things affect the brain and they confound so many studies of alcohol exposure, but here we were really able to get this like clean control.
Yeah. Sample, that's like good data. Right. Mm-hmm. And something that was measurable, 135 who had low levels and 135 who did not. And right. So then what did you find? Like what? Okay. So wait, maybe back it up. So what did you compare? Like there, you said there were scans and like, what were sort mm-hmm. of the things you compared against the low levels and the control group?
So we looked at brain imaging measures, and specifically we looked at this measure called fractional anisotropy, but it's a measure of
slow down.
Yep.
Okay.
It's a measure of brain connectivity.
Okay. Say the word again, fractional anisotropy.
Correct. Yes.
And that is,
it gets at brain connectivity.
Connection.
The white matter connections in your brain are what lets your brain, different parts of your brain communicate with
each other. It's like the network, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's, I know we have to even do this because mm-hmm. I remember I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'm good for a spoon.
No. These are, okay. So exactly. We're looking at brain connectivity.
Okay.
And we call it structural connectivity because it's actually the parts of your brain that are forming that connection. We looked at a different measure as well of brain function. So we looked a bit at structure and a bit at function, and we compared these between the groups. We also looked at behavior. So internalizing, that's like anxiety, depression, externalizing, that's like aggression, hyperactivity. We've looked at both of those behavior measures between the groups as well.
Okay. And then what did you find?
And so what we found is that there were several brain areas where fractional anisotropy, so brain connectivity, was weaker in the kids with prenatal alcohol exposure.
Not just one area, several areas.
That's right.
And when you say several areas, are you talking in terms of domains, or were you looking at something like more science-y?
We're talking about like actual locations within the brain. So we looked at...
Give me a couple of examples. So yeah. Like that weren't domain specific.
So we looked at, I don't have the exact number. Let's say we looked at 40 different regions in the brain.
Okay.
And five of them specifically were very robustly different in the group with prenatal alcohol exposure compared to controls. These are areas, they're involved in a variety of different things, but among them are things like visual processing, so like visual input, and motor function.
Which would be congruent with Dr. Popova's. Remember the 428 co-concurrent disorders, especially hearing, like you said. Okay, so
sensory,
that kind of
motor,
so that motor, so that backs it up.
And so these areas, the kids with the prenatal alcohol exposure had weaker connectivity than our control group.
So thus, when you see the symptoms of audio processing, right, and cognitive delays, like you see, like that would explain that.
Yes. And when we looked, so we were really strict with our statistical threshold. Like what that means is that when we did our analysis, we only took regions that we were very, very confident were different between the groups.
Okay. Like the standouts, right?
Right. A lot of other regions had more subtle differences. So I just want to make sure it's clear that these were the regions that were sort of the most different, but there are lots of other regions that were a little bit different.
And that would also explain, because it depends on when alcohol was consumed, like when in gestation, genetics, epigenetics, all those other factors, which makes individuals unique. But you did find these common areas. And so they were blatantly common. And then you were confident enough to say, absolutely, these ones. Am I
paraphrasing that's right? Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. So then you saw that there was different areas of functioning, or was that, did you just talk structure, or you just talk structure?
Just structure. We looked at function. We didn't see differences in brain function in this study.
Okay. So then why?
Let me be clear. Yeah. When I say brain function, I mean an imaging measure of brain function.
Okay.
When we looked at behavior, that's we saw differences. Point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And okay. And so what then were the behavioral differences than the control group?
So the kids with prenatal alcohol exposure had higher externalizing scores.
So internalizing is anxiety, depression.
That's right.
And externalizing would be aggression and
hyperactivity, for example.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was it blatantly higher? Like what was it, alarmingly higher? Like,
so mean scores were still in the normal range, and there was a difference of about 2.5 points. So when kids have a score over 65 is the cutoff for this test, it means they're in the clinical range, which means they might meet diagnostic criteria for ADHD or for a conduct disorder or something along those lines, an externalizing disorder. Okay. Most of the kids in both of the groups we looked at were well below that cutoff. Most of them were still in a very normal range of behavior. But more kids in the prenatal alcohol exposure group were worse than the kids in the control group.
Hmm. Okay. So what does this tell us? That it tells us that even low levels?
That is my interpretation, yes. That even low levels have an effect on the brain and behavior. So it doesn't mean that all kids who have a low level of prenatal alcohol exposure will have a behavior problem or a brain difference. But on a grand scale of things, when we look at this large group of 135 kids with exposure and 135 without, we are seeing effects that I think very strongly suggest low levels of alcohol do still affect kids.
When you say my interpretation, this study was also not Dr. Long, but also wasn't peer reviewed?
Yes. Yes.
So could we safely say that was others' interpretation from this? Or did you get, because sometimes you'd submit it and then they ask to say, well, clarify this a little bit more.
So we definitely modified it based on reviewer comments. That's very standard. The reason I say my interpretation is because we can never really prove causality. Okay, so we controlled for almost everything else we can think of that we know affects brain and behavior. So we controlled for age and sex. We matched those groups is what I mean when I say controlled. Yeah. We controlled for parent education, for caregiver status, for family income. So we took all these variables that we know can affect brain and behavior and we matched them, but we didn't control for genetics. So it's possible that there is some difference between the alcohol exposed kids and the controls that cause these brain differences and behavior differences. That's not the alcohol. So that's why I say my interpretation, we can't prove that it was the alcohol and not something else we didn't measure or didn't look at. But I think the associations are strong enough and the groups were clean enough that it's very likely that it's the alcohol.
Okay. So honest scientist, you know, that's the thing about science, right?
Yeah.
Science is never 100%. Okay.
Yes.
Then help the advocates out there. So, because now you publish this and there hasn't been a study, I think it even says to your knowledge, right? There hasn't been any work done on this. So I'm out and about in the community and I'm either training or I'm having a conversation with someone and they've heard that even low level amounts were okay, right? Now, having published this, what am I saying to that individual? Am I saying, what's the best way to arm that advocate when they're trying to explain it in layman's terms? Not the whole thing, but like a study has shown. Am I making sense of what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I think that that's fine. We use the word associated in our science interpretation because that's true. The low levels of alcohol exposure were associated with these brain and behavior changes in our study. So we're not saying they caused them. I do think they caused them. I think that's what's happening.
Yeah.
But what we really showed was this association. So we have, I think, nice, robust evidence now that low levels are associated with brain and behavior changes.
That's what I'm talking about. That's a great
and word, a really associated. Yeah. A very logical interpretation of that is that the low levels cause it. We know from animal studies that alcohol causes, you know, brain problems and behavior problems. We know that. So it's a really, I think, easy jump to make to a causal association, but we showed associations.
So where does the misinformation come from that it's okay? And now I know everybody might have a different, but where do you think, what's your opinion on that? I guess is where does people hear that it's okay to have a little bit during pregnancy?
So we don't have a lot of prior studies looking at low levels of exposure because a lot of these difficulties with measuring it and sample sizes, and sometimes it's hard to detect effects when you have a smaller study. And so a study wouldn't find anything and people would interpret that as meaning that it's fine. And I think, you know, there's a lot of cognitive bias there. People who want to consume alcohol or want to not worry about it.
Or they haven't seen the effects. The doctor or the OBGYN hasn't, like, the baby looks normal. Yep. Everything else seems to be on par. And it's not until the school years that we start to see the differences because of expectations.
You know, I'm sure you've heard this. I've definitely heard it. Well, my mom drank when she was pregnant with me and I'm fine.
Yeah. Right? Here's my rebuttal to that. I say, you know what, Catherine, I bet you are. And you look like someone I'd want to be friends with. But the thing is, what we can't study is loss of potential, right?
That, Jeff, I am totally on the same page with you there. That's exactly
what I say. That's what I say. So it's all the way from loss of potential to severe health and cognitive issues. So what could you have been?
And so I think that's the important thing in this study is we're not showing these kids, most of them don't have an actual behavior problem. We're just seeing a small difference from what they might have been like if they hadn't been exposed to alcohol, right? So it's all a spectrum. Behavior is a spectrum, brain is a spectrum. And the alcohol, I think, just shifts you where you are on that spectrum. It doesn't mean you're going to have a problem, but it's that loss of potential that you're seeing.
Yeah, like what could you have been? And I don't say that facetiously at all, because when you really have that conversation, people could say, well, there's definitely areas where I struggle. And maybe exposure contributed to that, right? And it doesn't mean you're an awful person or dumb or any of that. I think this is a good segue into even the, unless there's, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Oh yeah, I have one more question about this. And if you have other talking points about
it.
Sure. Yep. Usually studies have you asking more questions. Where do you go from here with this?
That's a really great question. The first thing, well, actually, there's two things I think we want to do in the immediate future. One is that these kids now have longitudinal data. So we want to look at them again 2 years later and see. So they're 9 years old. The kids in this study are nine.
Okay.
So we want to look at them again at 11 and see, do we see the same thing first? Because that's more convincing if we see it again at age 11. But also, do we see differences in how their brains grow over time and how their behavior changes over time based on the kids in the alcohol exposed group versus the controls? So what is it looking like as they get older and as they start approaching adolescence?
That's almost a segue to what you're doing now, right? One of the studies that you're doing now. I think that would be a great one. This is in your introduction to this current study, because I want to segue to the other one. So nearly 10% of pregnant individuals report consuming alcohol. Is that in general or is that just for this study?
That's from Stats Canada.
Okay.
So that's a Canadian average.
Yeah. And in our opinion, do we believe that's probably higher?
I think it's probably slightly higher than that. I think that's probably close. But
okay, right on. Yeah. Okay.
But with the caveat, that those are people who recognize that they're pregnant. So we're missing that group of people that are pregnant and drinking and just don't know they're pregnant yet.
Got it. Got it. Which would be a large population.
That would bring that number up.
Yeah. It's not their fault they didn't know. Nearly 10% of pregnant individuals report consuming alcohol, which can adversely affect fetal development and lead to a variety of behavioral and neurological deficits. A prenatal alcohol exposure is associated with the diagnosis of FASD. But couldn't even low levels now be associated if you meet that criteria? Like you show dysfunction in three of the brain domains?
So maybe. That's a much larger conversation.
Got it.
Especially given the smaller differences in behavior that we're seeing here. So these low levels are unlikely to push someone from normal functioning into a disorder, but they push them down that spectrum a little
bit,
if that makes
sense. Got it. Yeah. The sliding scale.
And regardless, the current diagnostic guidelines for FASD in Canada and elsewhere require heavy exposure.
Okay. So heavy exposure to, as it stands, heavy prenatal alcohol exposure is associated. That word is to see, we're all learning something today, with the diagnosis of FASD, a neurodevelopmental disorder that includes lifelong cognitive and behavioral difficulties. Prenatal alcohol exposure is also associated with an increased risk of mental health problems. More than 90% of individuals with FASD have co-occurring mental illness. Now this, the 90% is everything from anxiety, depression, to substance abuses, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep.
So
more severe ones like schizophrenia or those kinds are included as well. They're much less common, but yes.
Okay. So all of like
the whole spectrum of mental illness.
Yep. You're like everything covered. Yep. That is a frighteningly high number.
Yes, it is.
But you're doing some work about that. So we're going to now switch over to the study and we've had you on to talk about this too. And it's always good to get updates. So the study that you're currently working on is looking at mental health in individuals on the spectrum.
Yeah, we're really trying to understand better the links between brain differences and mental health in kids and youth with prenatal alcohol exposure. So what brain differences might be driving those mental health problems? How do those develop or change over time? So this growth aspect, especially adolescence, which is when so many mental illnesses emerge or are like are first recognized. So really, yeah, really trying to understand the links between alcohol exposure, brain, and mental health.
And so by doing this, you are recruiting. Tell me how the recruitment process works. So if people are listening to this and they meet that criteria, if they want to be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah. We are looking for kids and youth between 7 to 18 years old who have prenatal exposure to alcohol. It has to be confirmed exposure to do a study. It's a two-year study that has a brain MRI and some cognitive behavior assessments at the baseline. And then 2 years later, they come back for that whole thing again, the MRI and the behavior cognitive assessments. In between, they do a really short online questionnaire. So it's a two-year study with three sort of data collection time points. And it's happening in Alberta, so Calgary and Edmonton.
Okay. So if you meet those criteria, if you live there, if you can make it, where do they go to, who do they contact to say, I want to be up in that?
So maybe the easiest way is to email brainmri@ucalgary.ca.
Okay. And we'll also put that up in our blog post there. And what's your hypothesis?
So what we think is that the prenatal alcohol exposure causes some brain changes, and these brain changes make those individuals more susceptible to mental health problems. So it's essentially your brain is, you know, more vulnerable because of the exposure, which means that you're more likely to develop anxiety or depression or attention problems or hyperactivity or whatever it might be. But then I think that has a lot of implications for how we treat both FASD, but also the mental health problems that come along with it in so many cases.
Thus, then the goal is once we understand more, we understand better, how would that be relevant to a parent? What would that mean for them at the end game? What would they be able to do with your findings?
Within like the time frame of our study, you mean, or sort of
like after, like once you, you know, here's my hypothesis, this is what we found, this is what we know. Well, how is that going to benefit a parent to an individual on the spectrum?
The more we understand about how the brain links to the mental health difficulties we see, the better we, and I use that word very broadly, the better we can target treatment. So, you know, who's going to benefit most from a particular type of treatment? What type of treatment would be the most suited for that individual? When are those treatments most beneficial? Like, are they better early, or do we wait until adolescence to really, you know, use this particular form of treatment? So, and to try to predict. So we talk about targeting the right treatment to the right person at the right time. And the more we understand about the brain, the better we can get there. From a society perspective, we have limited resources. We need to best allocate those for the best outcomes, right? And from a personal level, you want your kid or yourself to get the treatment that's most likely to be effective quickly. You don't want to go through a whole bunch that aren't gonna do much for you.
And two more things. The first thing is, how do you stay motivated when you might not see that for 10 years? Like when you're going through all this stuff and writing all this stuff and doing all this stuff, science?
It's a good question. I mean, I'm a scientist, so I do love the discovery aspect of things, you know, figuring out something new, publishing a paper like this to me is exciting in and of itself, making a discovery that might not today, but one day make a difference. But ultimately, it's pretty amazing to work with the families who are so dedicated and so generous with their time and their data, even though they might not see the benefit of these studies, but just people care. And I like working with people who care so much. And it's really motivating to see that. It makes it easier for me to keep caring, I guess, when I see so many other people who care as well. And I'm hopeful. I think we can. I think this kind of work will make a difference. And in fact, it has. If you look, you know, 30 years ago at what we knew, we've come so far, right? So you kind of, I think you can kind of look back and realize that things do make a difference. This new research does make a difference in the end.
Oh, that's so good. I want to leave. We talk about hope. We talked, you know, about brain changes and 90% of individuals' mental health and behavioral issues. I think it's important to put out there that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be the person listening to this, their story. You could also say in your work, you found that the brain, the individual, the FASD brain can grow, correct?
Absolutely. And so, you know, I tend to characterize FASD as causing these lifelong challenges, but they're not permanent. Things change and brains grow. They keep growing into the 30s, right? Even so, brains are changing for a very long time, which means there's a lot of room for intervention. And even past age 30, people's brains change. They change every time we learn something, right? That's how you learn a new language or a new skill or whatever. So the brain is always changing. It's always susceptible to intervention for better or for worse. But we can make that for better if we provide a good environment.
See, that there we go. And that's where the parent can directly impact the individual's brain, is by creating that environment.
Yes.
And you can create a better environment when you know more about the work you're doing. You're doing good stuff, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, and my dog thinks so too, that you're also doing good work. Get out of here, please. So we want people, this is folks, we want people to, if you can, if you're in Calgary or Edmonton, does your lab do social media? Like, how can people like follow what you're doing and, you know, keep up to date with what's going on in your world and possibly help in the future if you need it?
Yeah. So our lab has a website, which I mentioned earlier, developmentalneuroimaginglab.ca. We also have an Instagram account, Labelle Neuroimaging, and a Facebook page with the same name, the Developmental Neuroimaging Lab. And then I'm on Twitter. The lab's not on Twitter, but I'm on Twitter and share a lot of this work. So Catherine A. Labelle.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just literally joined Instagram. It was about time. I reluctantly, you know, because there's so much, right? So much social media, but the people are there. So we got to meet them where the people are at. Dr. Labelle, you're the best. And I really appreciate you and your time coming on here to educate my audience about all the great work you're doing. And we appreciate it.
Well, thanks very much. It's really fun to be able to share it more broadly.
Yeah. And we can't wait, because of course we'll have you back when you get an update or something else that you're doing. So keep up the good work, buddy.
Thank you.
Dr. Labelle, you rule, dude. Thank you so much for being here and doing this as usual. You can see why she's a recurring guest. It's so important to get the science so we're not duped into this fake news and we're just chasing treatments and from articles that we read. It's important to hear it from the people who are doing it and really diving into these studies so it makes us better advocates. I just want to go over a few things that she talked about because I think it's really important. Like, let's start off right away with what she's saying. She's saying there's still a huge segment of the population that doesn't believe. We know the recommendations say no alcohol in pregnancy, but she still thinks there's a huge segment of the population that doesn't actually believe that. And so she believes that there's a real need for evidence to understand what low levels of prenatal alcohol are associated with terms of brain and behavior. And it's hard to get accurate data about exposure because that's not a good practice. You can't sit there and follow women they're consuming alcohol, having prenatal alcohol exposure during a live study. You kind of can't do that. So getting this data source from 11,000 children across the U.S. It's called the Adult Brain and Cognitive Development Study, and it was great that they put in the exact search terms that they were looking for and found 135 kids whose mom did indicate that there was some prenatal alcohol exposure and those that didn't. And so they took those kids with no exposure and they matched them on age, sex, family, income, caregiver status, and education. Then they looked at three areas of brain and imaging measures: brain connectivity, brain function, and behavior, both internal and external. Well, right, internal was anxiety, depression, external like hyperactivity and aggression. And so what did they find? And they found that there were several areas, five she believes, where brain connectivity was affected. These areas involved a variety of processes. For example, she talked about visual processing and motor skills. And there are other subtle differences in other regions, but those pulled out were most affected. They did not see differences in imaging of brain function. She has been on this podcast before and saying that MRI are not useful for either A, diagnosing, or B, an indicator of what part of the brain has been affected. You can go back and just go to our website, fasdsuccess.com/podcast. We have a search. Just type in Dr. LaBelle. She's been on our podcast a few times talking about MRIs. So again, she did not see differences in imaging of brain functioning, but they did see behavior differences. And she's talked about when kids have a score over 65, it means they're in the critical range. They might meet diagnostic criteria for ADHD or other conduct disorder. Most of the kids in both groups were well below the cut. Most in the normal range, but more kids were in the prenatal alcohol group, were worse than the kids in the control group, which would make sense from what we know about alcohol, what it does to the brain. So even low levels have an effect on the brain. It doesn't mean that all kids with prenatal alcohol exposure will have a behavioral problem or behavioral difference, but in the grand scale, they're seeing effects that she thinks very strongly suggests low levels of alcohol still affect kids. So think about that. We didn't have studies, but now we have a study. We can never, because we talk about 100%, you know, science is never 100%. We can never prove causality. We controlled for almost everything else, but we can think of that we know affects behaviors, but they can't control the cause. So I love when science says we don't know everything, but we know this as much as we do know. And then it comes down to that age-old question or that response that you get, that I get. I'll just reiterate that when people will tell you, well, you know, my mom drank and I'm fine, or this person drank and their kids are fine. And my response is always the same, just like I said on the podcast. You know what? You're probably right. I bet you're an incredible person. And if I spent more time with you, I'm sure we'd be buddies. But, you know, the spectrum is all the way from loss of potential to severe health and cognitive issues. And so what could you have been? You know, we all struggle with something in some areas. We can't diagnose loss of potential. So while many people could get through life fine, no problem, what could you have been? Where did it slightly possibly affect you? You know, and without being facetious. Now, what they want to do is look at these kids 2 years later and see if there's any differences in how the brain grows or behavior changes over time, what it looks like. They're always asking questions. And don't forget, they're also doing the study, the mental health study. So if you are in Alberta, if you are in Calgary or Edmonton, please don't hesitate. You can email brainmri at ucalgary.ca. We'll also have it on our website as well. Get involved. These people are doing the work. I know sometimes it feels like you're all alone in this, but I'm telling you, you're not. That's why I love to feature researchers and doctors and people who are trying to get those answers for you. And if you're an advocate and you listen to this, now you know you have some solid science that, yes, low levels of prenatal alcohol exposure still affects. Because I know you're working hard and they're working hard. So the best way to help them is if you can help them. You're a key in all of this. And if you meet the criteria, there's lots of different studies out there. And it's up to us. I don't think we should have the attitude of that, let somebody else do it. If you're able, and if you have the energy, and if your loved one could do it, jump in there. This isn't easy. It's hard, especially around a holiday like this. It might be a little bit harder. So you know how you get through it, especially if you're listening to this the week after, is just breathe through it, man. Any holiday is tough for our guys. So much stimulation. The routines are different. Your routines are different. And hopefully this week you're able to settle back into a routine. And if you're really having a tough time and you're doing this alone, you don't have to do this alone. We have a Facebook group. If you're not already in it, there's over 4,000 of you excellent, awesome folks. Just go to facebook.com/group/FASD forever and jump on in. There isn't a question there that would rattle anybody. And more often than not, there's more answers than you'll get in a lifetime of asking other people or doing research. And these caregivers know, and they've been there. We don't have to do this alone. We're the majority. You're the majority. FASD is the number one developmental disability on the planet. So there's no need to sit in a corner and think, hey, this is just me and my shitty parenting, because I tell you it's not. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. So much so that I am recording this in a corner of my office, just staring at the microphone. Because if this helps somebody, anybody, then it is all worth it. because I know people are listening out there. The numbers tell me. So you're not the only one going through this, although you might often feel like that. So join our freaking group. Join our group. Keep kicking ass. We got so much more to do. So many more cool people to come on here. I love and respect you, and you're going to get through this. Keep grinding. Do not stop. Do not stop. Your family loves and needs you. And having said that, I better get back to my family because they're not feeling good. All right. Have a great weekend. You're the best. Love you. Bye.